This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And it's great to have as my guest, Dr. David Banik. Dr. Banik, as many will remember, has been a frequent guest on our show. He is an infectious disease specialist. He is also the associate professor of medicine and head of the infection prevention program at the University of Connecticut. And it's really apropos that we have him on now because there are so many things going on, even other than the confusion we're hearing coming out of CDC, the HHS. We now have what are apparent to everybody, a group of unqualified people trying to direct our health care. And we really need to get facts, and that's why we're having Dr. Banik on, to really let's find out what we should be doing, especially here in Connecticut. Most recently, we just had mosquitoes in Groton testing positive for West Nile virus. I've heard of 3 cases now of West Nile virus in the past year. And this is a very, very potent virus in some people. Some people, again, don't get very ill, but others develop encephalitis and eventual paralysis. So we want to know what we should be doing about that. And some of the new ways and sprays that you could avoid this if you're out hiking or golfing, especially in the fall. There's been a Legionnaires outbreak in New York City. Many of you will remember the original Legionnaires disease when it was diagnosed as people became quite ill at an American Legion convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So we want to talk to him about that. And obviously, we want to touch on COVID, RSV, the flu, and what we should be doing regarding vaccination in those things. You know, one of the things that I've said has been a great part of this show has been the fact that it's a local show, and we get local input, and even as I'm winding down the show, I'm still going to have that email at info@alessimd.com. And it's been helpful for some of you. I've had requests for referrals. Who would I recommend for this problem or that problem? And I'm happy to pave the way for people to get good care from qualified people. So that's still going to go on after we end the program. But the thing I like also is the local input. So last week our guest was Dr. Carrie Ann Silverman, and Dr. Silverman is an OBGYN, and she talked to us a lot about postnatal care and a program where they're using orange wristbands to identify women who had just given birth in that postnatal period, which is 6 weeks after giving birth. And how women are prone to certain injuries, especially cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease, various clots. So this would identify them when EMS people come upon them. I had an email last week from Rosemary saying that orange was also being used for DNR, do not resuscitate. Then I got an email from John. Again, all local. John saying he thought it was red was the wristband. And there's been confusion about all this. He thought red was DNR. So the FDA then recommends that purple be the color for DNR. So here's what we have found out in conjunction with Dr. Silverman. The orange wristband for designating someone as being postnatal or having just given birth, and maternal, a maternal vulnerable to maternal diseases, is quite distinctive. But Connecticut, as opposed to other places in the country, does use orange for DNR. But they are distinctive in terms of how they appear for EMS people. So the reason I bring this up is, again, we all learn something. And I thought that that's important to share this week with all of you. There was another article that I came across, and it was an article that said Project 2025, the group, wants another baby boom. And I found this interesting. It was a group from something called the Heritage Foundation who wants a Manhattan Project to spur heterosexual married couples to have more kids. And their idea was that they would steer funding from child care programs like Head Start toward individual families, individual couples who are married and, again, heterosexual, and so that parents can stay home rather than going to work and raise the family. And other than the fact that I found this personally repulsive, the idea that you want to propose having more children, when we found out last week from Dr. Silverman that the maternal death rate in the United States is the highest of any industrialized nation. I was shocked. You know, there are some times on this show when I'm shocked. I was shocked to hear that and actually researched it. I mean, and when we say industrialized nations, you know, there are a lot of them. We're not just talking about China and Russia. I mean, we're talking about Italy, Sweden, India. We're the worst when it comes to that. And 60% of the problems that these women are dying from are treatable. So my point here is not a political one, but a practical one. If indeed you are proposing that women have more children and we start a baby boom, you better fix the problem first. The problem being that women are dying after giving birth. So, and again, you know, you want to promote better health for children, but nobody wants to address the direct cause of death in children, which are guns. So we've really lost our priorities here. And so we need to really revisit that. And we need to do that as voters, as citizens, if we're going to move forward. So with that, I think we need to keep an eye on that. Now, a lot of you are saying, well, how could that be? And as Dr. Silverman presented last week, it's mostly in rural communities. It's in Mississippi. It's in places where they don't have access to care. So the point here is also, all right, how do we fix the problem? It's a fixable problem. It takes money. It takes encouraging people to nurses, midwives, physicians to get involved in public health, go to work for the public health service. Rather than cutting positions in the public health service, you want to expand those positions so that we get more care to people in rural communities before we start encouraging them to have more children. I mean, it's absolutely crucial when we go forward. This day in medicine I found to be also very interesting. On September 13th, 1851, Dr. Walter Reed was born. And everybody knows Walter Reed from the name of the well-known Army Hospital in Washington, D.C. He was head of the United States Army Yellow Fever Board in 1901. And he confirmed in 1901 a theory by a Cuban doctor, Carlos Finley, that yellow fever came and was transmitted by a mosquito species rather than direct contact with an individual. Now, this was a huge insight, right, because it gave impetus to the new field of epidemiology and biomedicine. These are the statistics. This is public health. And it's believed that that was really the beginning of modern public health. From a practical standpoint, it allowed, almost immediately allowed, people to go back to work to complete the Panama Canal in 1904, from 1904 to 1914, by the United States. And Walter Reed followed that work and really worked with another doctor, Dr. George Sternberg, who was called the first United States bacteriologist. So Dr. Reed really changed everything when it comes to infectious disease and mosquito-borne illness. Now, many people will say, well, what's yellow fever? Well, I've never heard, I've never seen a case of yellow fever, and neither have I, because most of the cases have been seen in Africa. Matter of fact, 90% of them are seen in Africa. 200,000 people were infected worldwide each year. And there are about 30,000 deaths just from yellow fever. And the treatment of yellow fever is vaccine. You can vaccinate against yellow fever. And fortunately, that's why it's been contained so much and needs to be treated more aggressively. So again, we salute Dr. Walter Reed for his contributions to medicine. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. David Banik. As many people know, he is an infectious disease specialist. And if you have questions for Dr. Banik, and I'm sure there are, I've already received, you know, I mentioned it last week on the program that he was going to be on, and I already have quite a few questions about COVID. So if you have questions about COVID treatment, Paxlovid, vaccine, you could reach out to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you. And it's a special day because I have as my guest Dr. David Banik, who is an infectious disease specialist, associate professor of medicine, and head of the Infection Prevention Hospital Program at the University of Connecticut. And apropos, I just had a question from Pat, so I'm going to throw this one right out to Dr. Banik. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Dr. Leslie, thanks for having me back.
Quick question here. This is from Pat. I've been hearing a lot about drinking raw milk. Are there benefits and risk to drinking raw milk?
So, thanks for that question. I think, there's certainly a diversity of opinions on raw milk. I think in terms of health benefits, there may be some benefits out there. There's some talk about sort of the natural nutrients associated with raw milk. But, from an infectious disease perspective, there are some risks. So, milk is pasteurized, which essentially removes harmful organisms, specifically bacteria and viruses. There are certain bacteria that tend to colonize milk and can be harmful to humans, particularly those who are older, those who are immune compromised. And that's why the pasteurization process is so important. So, I would really be very reluctant and cautious in consuming raw milk because of some of those potential infection consequences associated with it.
Okay, Pat, I hope that answered the question. From my standpoint, I'm not touching the stuff. But let's get into it. David, let's talk a couple of things I wanted to touch on. The West Nile virus. Are we seeing more of that here in Connecticut?
So I think when it comes to West Nile virus, this is typically the time of the year that we see it here in Connecticut. It's mosquito infection. Typically late summer, early fall is when we see cases. Now, there have been cases here in Connecticut. We just, had our first case in the last couple of weeks that was identified in humans. But they test the mosquitoes in the area, and they are finding mosquitoes that are infected with the virus. So we may see more cases. I think this is really a time of year when important to, you know, use that mosquito protection if you're concerned about West Nile. When you go outside, put on some mosquito spray, try to be cautious with, you know, being around those mosquitoes. But I think we may see cases in the next month or two. This is typically when we see them. And usually by the end of October, once the mosquitoes are no longer out, we stop seeing cases here in Connecticut.
Someone mentioned to me using sprays with Picardin versus DEET. Is there a difference? Is Picardin something better? Am I even pronouncing it properly?
Yeah, so there's a few different options out there, including DEET and Picardin. You know, they're, I think, you know, I think the best option is for folks to just jump online, go to the CDC website, and I believe EPA also has a list of approved insecticides. So I would take a look at those lists. There's many products out there. You know, DEET has kind of been the standard, but there are other ones available that really offer that protection against mosquitoes.
Okay. The next thing I wanted to touch on was Legionnaire's disease. We had an outbreak recently in New York. Can you talk a little bit about Legionnaire's disease and maybe some of the history behind it and treatment and what we need to do about that or how to protect ourselves?
Sure. So, yeah, Legionnaire's has gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of months. So, you know, Legionnaire's disease is caused by a bacteria called Legionella. It causes pneumonia. And sometimes that pneumonia can be quite severe and even fatal. You know, interesting, the history is interesting. You know, I think the first outbreak that was identified was at a in the American Legion convention in Philadelphia, you know, many years ago. And it was associated with contamination of the ventilation system. And that's actually where Legionnaires becomes a major public health issue. So, you know, there is Legionnaires out there. It's even present in some of the water, the bodies of water here in Connecticut. But infections associated with outdoor bodies of water are pretty uncommon. But when we see outbreaks, you know, that's a concern. And that actually was what got the attention recently in New York City. There were some cooling towers associated with a hospital in Harlem, New York, that became colonized with Legionella. And that was actually what caused a lot of those infections that were occurring in sort of a cluster and outbreak in New York City. And when we see that, that's alarming, particularly in a healthcare facility where we have a lot of vulnerable people that are getting healthcare. So, you know, unfortunately, that was addressed, and I believe the cooling system was remediated and that was fixed. But you know, and everyone should be aware that this is something that we monitor for in our hospital and all hospitals. You know, here in Connecticut, there's requirements to do testing, and we do testing in certain higher risk locations in the hospital to make sure our water's not contaminated. But I think in terms of the overall health risk, you know, generally low, but, you know, when they do occur, particularly in these clusters, they can be they can cause quite an impact.
Do you test for it frequently in people coming into the emergency room or people coming into the hospital?
So we do. You know, if we see, you know, it's not a universal thing where every patient coming in with pneumonia gets tested for it, but if the patient does come in with certain symptoms that we tend to associate a little bit more with Legionella, some laboratory findings, and maybe some exposure, then those would be the kinds of patients that we focus our testing on.
Is it a blood test, a sputum test? How do you test for Legionella?
So there's a couple of ways to do it. The one that's most commonly used is there's actually a urine test that we can detect the antigen from the bacteria. So part of the bacteria present in the urine samples in folks that have Legionella infection. That's probably the most common because it's quick and relatively easy to do. It can also be tested in like the sputum of patients that have pneumonia. But really the urine test is kind of the standard clinical test that we use for patients.
And you treat it with antibiotics?
Yep, it is treated with antibiotics. There's a couple of very specific antibiotics that we use for Legionella that are a little bit different than the routine antibiotics that we use to treat sort of your standard pneumonia. So it is important to identify for that purpose.
You touched on an interesting topic of community monitoring, and we've heard a lot about monitoring sewer water. It came out when we had COVID. What kind of systems do we use to monitor for infectious disease in the community?
So, yeah, I mean, that's a great question. There's a lot of systems out there. So we do we have monitoring that's done. We call it surveillance done at the public health level. You know, there's syndromic surveillance. So, for instance, we can identify all the patients coming into like Connecticut emergency departments with flu illness or with pneumonia, we collect that in sort of real time at the public health level so that we can identify if there's like an uptick in, you know, all of a sudden we've had an increase in patients coming in with flu-like illness. I mean, that could indicate that there's something going on, like an outbreak or, you know, something brewing at sort of the larger level. But there's also infections that we do at the laboratory or surveillance we do at the laboratory level. So, for instance, for certain bacteria, you know, every time we get a positive test, we send it to the Department of Public Health. And that way we know that if there's sort of an uptick in a certain organism that we see more frequently or, you know, even things like Legionella, you know, then we can identify and respond accordingly. So there's this whole sort of syndromic and also laboratory-based surveillance. But, you know, I think it's really important, and this is something that always gets a lot of attention when we're looking at funding for public health. And, you know, funding surveillance systems is really critical. And, I mean, I think we have to be mindful that if we stop funding those, you know, there could be consequences.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with my guest, Dr. David Banik. If you have questions for us, you can reach us at info@AlesiMD. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you and to have as my guest, Dr. David Banik. David, let's get right down to it. COVID's on everybody's mind these days. We're getting into that season where we start seeing an uptick in cases. What are we expecting this year as far as COVID goes in terms of spread and how viral it's going to be?
So, you know, I think it's always a little difficult to predict, you know, COVID. And, you know, I sort of now I'm grouping it with the other respiratory viruses. You know, we tend to see upticks in the winter months. So, you know, it's going to be difficult to predict how impactful, you know, COVID's going to be this season. But I do expect it'll circulate. Now, last winter, we saw an uptick in sort of December, but then a little bit in like the February, March period. So I'm anticipating we'll see similar. You know, I think the extent of it is always a little hard to predict. But nonetheless, I do expect we'll see COVID circulating in the community.
Is it a different variant this year? We've always hear about these different variants of them. Is it a different variant we're dealing with this year?
So, I mean, the predominant variant in the recent month is this J1 variant. It's a derivative of, you may remember Omicron is like the main variant, but then we have these subtypes. So that seems to be the one that's been circulating recently. I think it's expected that'll be circulating, but, you know, we may see a mix of different, like, sub-variants that are circulating, but they're all, you know, Omicron variants.
Do we have a safe and effective vaccine available this year?
So we do. We have the same COVID mRNA vaccine that's been available in the last few years. There's a few different options. There's a Moderna and Pfizer, and those are available, and or at least they're becoming available. You know, I think that this is in the last couple of weeks. There's been kind of a rollout to pharmacies in the area. So we do have a vaccine available, and you know, certainly recommended for older folks and anyone with any high risk conditions. And, you know, I think at retail pharmacies and health clinics, we should be seeing that available soon.
Okay. Well, I have a question for you of my own, actually. So people who work in healthcare, right, like myself, like you, are we considered in a high to be in a higher risk group?
So I think, you know, the Department of Public Health here in Connecticut just put out guidelines last week. And they do include healthcare professionals as a recommended group for vaccination. I think the risk for healthcare workers as a general group is more high risk of exposure. You know, we're around people who are sick, symptomatic, and also, you know, concerned that if a lot of healthcare workers become sick, that could impact the healthcare workforce, which is going to be impactful. In terms of the individual risk, I mean, a lot of that is based on age and medical conditions. So, I mean, the healthcare worker in terms of their own individual risk of getting sick would be similar to a non-healthcare worker with the same medical profile. But I think that increased risk of exposure was what prompted our Connecticut Department of Public Health to include healthcare professionals on the list of vaccine recommendations for vaccine.
So there are obvious differences between what the state of Connecticut and your group are proposing versus the federal government, which has really narrowed the criteria or the indication for a COVID vaccine. What are the differences other than healthcare workers? For example, are we advocating for pregnant women to be receiving the COVID vaccine?
So there are some differences. You know, we talked about healthcare workers. Pregnant women is another group that there are some differences. National guidance does not specifically recommend pregnant women be vaccinated for COVID-19, whereas the state guidance does and actually advocates for that as a, being a group that should be targeted. I mean, I think both federal and state guidance recommend that older folks, anyone with any high-risk conditions be vaccinated, and that really is a critical group, probably the most critical group to get vaccinated. So, you know, that's really, I think that's a big message, is that the group that benefits the most from vaccination are really those individuals with higher risk, any risk conditions, as well as older individuals. But there are other groups, like you mentioned, pregnant women and healthcare workers that are included in the state guidance as well.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, the reason pregnant women get vaccinated is so that the newborn will have some antibodies transiently through the placenta. Is that correct?
That's correct. It offers protection to the infant, but also, you know, data throughout the pandemic show that pregnant women, particularly those in like later stages of pregnancy themselves, are at higher risk for severe infection. So I think there's kind of that dual benefit to both mom and baby.
Okay, so I want to be clear that that is within the state of Connecticut that they should get it. How about children with their first series of vaccinations? Is COVID included in Connecticut or recommended in Connecticut? I know it's not federally.
So, I think with children, you know, I think the main focus for children are those individuals who have any risk conditions. So any of the medical illnesses that put children at higher risk for severe infection are included. You know, in terms of standard recommendations, I think Connecticut put forth that sort of healthy children or children without high-risk medical conditions can receive a vaccine. I mean, that really becomes kind of an individual discussion with between healthcare providers and their patients. You know,
right.
I think you know, the state will support them, will support vaccination for healthy children without medical comorbidities. But I think the strongest recommendation is really for those who are at higher risk because of their medical conditions.
So when you say support, does that mean it gets paid for? Because I'm hearing stories about people in other states where it's not being paid for, and insurance may not pay for it. So do you know how that's arranged here in Connecticut? Is it being supported by the Department of Public Health and the state?
Yes, I think that's really in the last, that's a really important point. And over the last week, Governor Lamont actually has stepped in and has specifically said that he will work with insurance companies to ensure that anyone who wants to receive a COVID vaccine will be able to get one, and that the insurance companies here in Connecticut will be covering that. So I think that's happening at the state level. I think, you know, Massachusetts, Connecticut, a few other states have really taken that initiative to do that, to work with insurance companies to ensure that COVID vaccine access is universal. So I think that's a big step that the governor's taken, and I think, you know, I think there's good a lot of people are pleased about that.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. You know, we don't see the same number of deaths we saw from COVID at its peak, or even hospitalizations as we did before. Is that because probably everyone has some level of immunity at this point, either through vaccination or exposure? Why are we not seeing those severe numbers anymore?
Yeah, I think that is the rationale. I think, you know, we've seen over the last few years, you know, most people have been exposed to COVID or been vaccinated, and in fact, most people probably both here in Connecticut. And I think that's why we've seen lesser of an impact than we had in like the earlier stages of the pandemic. So I think that's good. That's important. You know, I think also we should be mindful that, you know, the immunity can wane. You know, we expect that will happen with COVID as well as, you know, other respiratory viruses. So, you know, keeping up with those vaccines, particularly among those who are at the higher risk groups, is still going to be important.
Is it worthwhile to get the vaccine more than once a year for those who are at risk?
So, yeah, there's some specific guidance that those individuals with higher risk conditions should get the vaccine more frequently, you know, even every 6 months. So I would encourage folks, if you're concerned that because of your medical conditions, you know, you may need to get a more frequent COVID vaccine, have that discussion with your physician to really clarify if you're within that group of individuals. There's a lot of conditions, immunocompromised folks, folks with other medical conditions that should be vaccinated more frequently. That's really that's something that people should be mindful of and have that discussion.
I want to move on to treating it. You know, Paxlovid was what we were recommending in the past. Is Paxlovid still recommended in people who, you know, test early or contract the COVID early? Are we still using it?
We are. So Paxlovid is still available and recommended. I think, you know, in terms of Paxlovid, I think the real benefit are those individuals who are at highest risk. You know, I think, you know, when I think about my patients, you know, anyone who's calling me, they just tested positive for COVID and they have some other risk, higher risk conditions. That's the group that I'm thinking about really focusing Paxlovid on. And I think, you know, for younger, you know, healthy individuals without any medical conditions, I think, you know, the benefit may be less in those groups. But it is still available. And, you know, I think if you do, you know, have COVID, test positive, yeah, I'd have that discussion with your clinician to see if you're within that group that should receive it.
I had someone reach out to me and let me know that their insurance, they had regular insurance, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and it didn't cover Paxlovid. It was a $1,500 outlay. Have you heard those stories?
You know, I haven't. You know, I haven't heard that becoming an issue with Paxlovid specifically. You know, that is evolving, you know, like with any of our medications. So it's something I think we should keep on the radar.
What about Paxlovid rebound? We heard about that a lot, right? I think Anthony Fauci had it. I think several people had it. Is that an issue still, people getting rebound? And can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so Paxlovid rebound, that's often something that, you know, we've seen, you know, I would say, I wouldn't say frequently, but in a sizable proportion of individuals who are receiving it, where, you know, after treatment, finishing up their usually a 5-day course of Paxlovid, they develop a sort of resurgence of symptoms again. Now, I think there's still a question as to whether or not that represents like active infection or if it's more like a sort of body's immune response to the virus. But we do still see it. You know, generally it's pretty short lived and, you know, folks kind of recover pretty quickly from it. But it can still happen with Paxlovid. I think as time moves on, we see more and more, you know, changes with immunity and with the virus. You know, we'll have to keep an eye on that.
A question I had here from Bob, and that was ventilation. In other words, are we seeing COVID? Is it spread through ventilation systems like on an airplane? Or in an office, is that the way it's spread, or is that even a method of spread?
So, you know, I don't think we've seen it spread through ventilation, but what we do see is in like poorly ventilated areas.
Okay.
You know, person to person spread. So, you know, we think about like kind of cramped environments and, you know, areas that just don't get good air circulation. Those are the situations where we see COVID spread in groups. But it hasn't really been linked to, like, circulation in a ventilation system, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Talking about people in close quarters, right, that was our biggest fear before. You're in an elevator or even airports, right? There are certain choke points, right, when you're going through TSA or when people get – this one always gets to me. When people have to – as soon as the plane lands, right, everybody stands up, okay? Everybody yeah. stands up. They're on top of each other. No doors are open, okay? And everybody's standing around breathing on each other. I guess what I'm getting at is, are you still recommending masks in those situations? What would you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that becomes kind of an individualized situation. So, and, you know, different people are viewing their overall risk differently. So, you know, I think about, like, the full spectrum of folks that I take care of. You know, I see some young, healthy people coming in who, you know, generally, even if they did get COVID, would probably recover pretty well. Those people, you know, masking, I think, has sort of less of a benefit. And, you know, there's, I guess, some potential downside of the discomfort of wearing a mask. But, you know, my elderly patients, my patients who are very immunocompromised, you know, those folks, I think taking that added layer of protection of wearing a mask in those crowded environments is pretty reasonable. So I think everyone's got to kind of look at their own sort of risk-benefit profile and, you know, feel kind of size up based on their situation, you know, when a mask might be offer that added layer of protection.
I had a question from Catherine, and I thought this was a good one. Are certain people more susceptible based on race or ethnicity, are there people more susceptible to COVID? And I wanted to bring it up from the standpoint that, you know, some people get COVID, some people don't. I know of a good close friend of mine who's a physician, was around COVID during its peak, never got it. Are there certain racial, ethnic propensities or defenses?
So I think that's an interesting and important question that we're still trying to understand with COVID and also with other, you know, respiratory viruses. You know, certainly early on in the pandemic, we saw a disproportionate impact on of COVID on minority populations. But I think kind of understanding the details of whether that's related to, you know, socioeconomic and social situations or an actual like medical predisposition to illness, I think it's still something we're trying to understand and get a better grasp on. There was also concern that certain communities had challenges with accessing healthcare early on in the pandemic, and you know, maybe that resulted in more severe consequences in certain communities. So I think there's a lot of social and probably individual like health related factors that play into that that we're still trying to get a grip on, but definitely an important topic to keep working on understanding.
We're chatting today with Dr. David Banik about infectious disease. We're talking about COVID, but at this point, let's move on. Respiratory syncytial virus. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's something we're going to start seeing this time of year as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important topic to bring up. So respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, is the term that that we commonly hear about. And, you know, it's a virus that circulates typically in winter months and can cause really severe infections. In fact, I think in the last few years, we've come to appreciate that it's probably even more impactful than we initially thought. In terms of causing illness. You know, it's the kind of virus that can cause illness in anyone, but we tend to see the more severe infections in individuals as they get older, and also for like very young young children, young babies as well can be impacted the most. So, and now, you know, we're in a fortunate place where we have protection in the form of a vaccine, as well as now we have a monoclonal antibody that we can offer to young children. So the vaccine really is, you know, focused on older folks. The standard recommendation is above age 75 should get an RSV vaccine. But now there's a recent expansion to get approval for vaccination for younger individuals, so older than 50 who have one or more medical conditions that may make them more at risk for RSV disease. So, you know, that vaccine is available. You know, retail pharmacies are carrying it, and I really encourage individuals, especially older individuals, to go and get that vaccine. It's a one-dose vaccine. It's different than COVID and flu, where there's multiple doses that need to be given. But right now, it's just a one-dose, one-time vaccine, and, you know, it does provide protection.
So you get it one time. You don't have to get it every year.
At this point, that's correct. I mean, there's still ongoing study to look to see if immunity kind of wanes over time, and it's possible that down the road there may be a role for a revaccination. But right now, it's just a one lifetime dose for eligible individuals.
How bad is flu going to be this year?
Oh, Dr. Leslie, always hard to predict that. But we'll, you know, I think we're anticipated to see flu circulate. You know, no one really knows the timing, and you know, we look at data from the Southern Hemisphere. They had a pretty severe season, not the most, but you know, there was flu circulating. So we're anticipating to see flu. You know, the timing and the severity is always hard to predict. You know, I think this is a good time to be thinking about what you can do to protect yourself. And at this point, it's really a flu vaccine, which is now readily available. And, you know, I always encourage folks to think about, you know, September and October is really a good time to get that flu vaccine to protect you through the months that we typically see flu, which is usually November through, like, you know, February, March.
We get them both at the same time?
You can. Yep, they're both, you know, you can get both vaccines at once. In fact, now there's a some late stages developing combination vaccines. So hopefully, you know, we'll see that in the future to eliminate the need for two different vaccines. But yeah, you can receive both in one visit.
Okay. So, and, you know, I've heard a lot of different things. Oh, you should get one in each arm. You shouldn't get it in the same arm. Is there any difference?
it's an important area that we're studying, but I think at this point, no conclusion as far as like switching arms and, you know, whether getting the same two vaccines in the same arm or different arms, is the way to go. But, an interesting topic and one I think, that's currently under, under study. So maybe at one day in the future, we'll have some more, guidance on that.
So it sounds like we're still learning a lot about all of these things, right now in terms of how they're spread and how we can, stop and treat them. The usual things, if you get COVID, other than Paxlovid, recommendations?
You know, I think, you know, from a clinical perspective, you know, I would, you know, have the discussion with your clinician, to see if there's anything specific for you. And then in terms of contagiousness, you know, bear in mind that, you know, you're around other individuals, you may be contagious. So, you know, doing things like trying to, you know, stay away at least until you recover from your illness, and then wearing a mask is still a worthwhile thing, especially if you're concerned that you're going to spread to family members or close contacts who may be at higher risk. You know, I think just like we think about with other viruses, you know, being mindful of those around us when we're sick and trying to protect others is still important.
How long should you isolate after diagnosing COVID?
So, yeah, I think there are some differences in sort of public health recommendations. You know, my general guidance in terms of isolation is, you know, really once you're feeling better for, you know, a good, you know, after like 2 or 3 days or so from recovering from your illness, you're okay to go out. But I would still encourage folks to wear a mask. You know, the recommendation is to wear a mask for, you know, upwards of 7 days after symptom onset. To try to help, especially if you're going to be in close contact with individuals, and definitely especially if you're going to be in close contact with someone who's particularly vulnerable. That's really the right situation to be wearing a mask to try to protect them.
David, thank you very much. Thanks for your time today.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Leslie.
Thanks for coming on. We're going to take a short break. They're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. And in wrapping up the show, last week I announced that I'm going to be ending the show at the end of this year. If you folks have, listeners have guests or topics you want me to cover in these few weeks we have left, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com as always. One of the big topics I think that we really, and I always get questions on, is dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and there's so much out there. There's an at-home test for Alzheimer's disease now. The shingles vaccine is believed to be able to guard against dementia. And there's the issue of federal cuts that are ongoing for Alzheimer's. So that is one of the topics I really want to tackle. You know, people have always gotten in touch with me about stem cells. Stem cells have not been proven in any way, shape, or form to reverse dementia, to reverse Parkinson's disease, or other neurodegenerative disorders. If you are so inclined that you want to do something like that, you should get involved in a clinical trial. There are clinical trials available for stem cells in a lot of different areas. There probably are some available for dementia. But when people say, just bring your money, okay, or you'll have to pay cash for this, and I know sometimes you feel desperate and you want to take any shot you have, please be wary, especially when it comes to neurodegenerative disorders. Many thanks to Dr. David Banik for spending some time with us today. As always, many thanks to Kevin Corza, who's been on the board for us. Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we will be back live, and I haven't come up with a topic yet, so maybe I'll get a good suggestion from one of you. As always, if you missed any part of today's program, the Healthy Rounds podcast is available by going to Audacy.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.